Okay, hello everyone. I think I'm going to start. I'm so pleased to welcome you all today to this panel that is on rewriting the self. We have three really wonderful papers. We're going to follow the kind of normal format of I'll introduce each speaker before they go, and then we'll save questions to the end. So I'm really delighted to introduce Susan Savalas. She's presenting on Beyond the Power of Utterance, Reading the Linguistic Gaps in Mary Robinson's Memoirs. Susan is a senior lecturer in English literature at Canterbury Christchurch. Her research focuses on romantic writers, and she has a special interest in women's writing in the long 19th century. She's especially interested in authorial and textual afterlives, life writing, genre formation, the rise of print, periodical, and celebrity culture. She's currently working on a monograph entitled Women's Life Writing, Romanticism and Reputation, Bernie Wollstonecraft Robinson Hayes. The book examines four women writers whose autobiographies, diaries, memoirs, and or autobiographical fiction have influenced their own reputations and also contributed to the development of genre in life writing in its formative period. So, Susan.
Thank you. Today I'm going to be talking about Mary Darby Robinson, who is featured here, and her memoirs of the late Mrs. Robinson, written by herself, published the year after she died. For those of you who don't know her, Robinson was an actress, a writer, and most notoriously, the first royal mistress of the Prince Regent, later King George IV. So she was a national celebrity in her day, and her life, with its stage and print successes, as well as its sexual transgressions, was known to her contemporaries. Yet the memoirs narrate events of her life, selectively, leaving out large portions of her life and breaking off completely at the most infamous moments, such as when she finally agrees to join the Prince Regent in his private apartments. The narration, when it resumes, switches to the third person, as a third party steps in to finish it, though this third person narration soon gives way to a long-lost letter, supposedly written by Robinson and found by her editor, which suspiciously picks up just where the previous section left off. Finally, the memoirs switches between moments of anguished feeling and self-reflection and minute descriptions of clothing and society that suggest her ambition and vanity. These omissions, disruptions, and contradictions destabilize the tale of feminine transgression, suffering, and redemption in motherhood that Robinson constructs in the memoirs as a, quote, vindication of her reputation. As a result, many modern critics have seen Robinson's memoirs as a final but flawed attempt to defend her conduct and rescue a tarnished reputation. The gaps in her narrative are taken as evidence of her problems in maintaining subjectivity, adopting a position outside the prescripted poses of romantic femininity, and reconciling her sexually transgressive public reputation with the ideals of female conduct acceptable to her audience. However, today, I'd like to focus on a little-noticed pattern of silence in the memoirs that may allow for a different interpretation. Throughout the autobiography, moments of emotional intensity are described paradoxically as, quote, undescribable or beyond the power of utterance. In these climactic moments, of which there are over 25 in the memoirs, Robinson draws attention to the gaps in her narrative and indicates an inability or an unwillingness to reveal herself completely. In Robinson's overt and repeated flagging of these silences, she tells us that she isn't telling us everything, and hints at a complex mode of self-representation that pervades the memoirs. Announcing her silences in this way, I'm suggesting, is a strategic move that accentuates her sensibility, secures a degree of feminine privacy, while at the same time evoking sympathy and kindling our curiosity. It is a purposeful balancing act that allows her to maintain a respectable femininity, but also to retain her fascination as a celebrity. I'd like to turn now to three examples of these self-professed silences to show you how this rhetorical trope plays out. So the first of these takes place in the narrative when Robinson is married at the age of 15. She explains how she's been convinced by her mother to marry the much older Thomas Robinson, who is, after the ceremony, revealed to have been lying about his professional status, his birth, and his fortune. Robinson describes herself as wretched, and when she returns to visit her hometown of Bristol, she finds a melancholy solace in going to the church where she used to sit and sing and read as a child. There, she listens to the morning service and says, "Language cannot describe the sort of sensation which I felt when I heard the well-known, long-remembered organ flinging its loud peal through the Gothic structure. The moldering walk was gloomy, and my spirits were depressed beyond description. I stood alone, wrapped in meditation. Here, said I, did my infant feet pace to and fro." Now, critics have noticed that Robinson fashions herself in the memoirs as a Gothic heroine of sensibility. And here she certainly demonstrates the fine emotional and aesthetic responses that would do justice to any Radcliffe protagonist. Robinson also here writes from the vantage point of a mature woman of 42 who is reflecting on her 15-year-old self, who is in turn nostalgically remembering her childhood. She explains, "The melancholy propensities of my earliest infancy seemed to revive with an instinctive energy which rendered them the leading characteristics of my existence." In other words, the Mary Robinson of childhood, adolescence, and adulthood is consistent in temper of soul. Robinson posits this as her true self. And in showing it to us, she means, she says, quote, "not to write my own eulogy, but to succeed in my vindication," claiming that the world has mistaken the character of my mind. I have ever been the reverse of volatile and dissipated. Despite her loveless marriage to an unworthy suitor, an unworthy husband, she affirms that fidelity and honor and feminine rectitude attached her to him. She's distressed that she's been taken for a dissolute woman, interjecting again on the next page with feeling, "Ah, how little has the misjudging world known of what has passed in my mind, even in the apparently gayest moments of my existence. How much have I regretted that ever I was born." Robinson's exclamations indicate a status of double victimhood. She was not only at the mercy of her propensity for sorrow, but was misconstrued as volatile and dissipated. Her self-named vindication in the memoirs is predicated on persuading us that her real character is not what people have thought, but what she shows us here. Yet the linguistic incapacity she professes in this passage functions in different ways. It's a testament to her honesty and an emphasis of the depth of her feeling that reinforces her bid for sympathy. But there may be another way in which it operates. It also creates a tension between being misunderstood on the one hand and failing to fully make herself understood on the other. Of course, we get the sensation must have involved sorrow and melancholy and regret. But we wonder, did it contain other inflections as well? Frustration, anger, resentment? And are there other unspeakable things she can't relate? Less acceptably feminine feelings or otherwise unmentionable content may be implied in the cracks left open by Robinson's failure of language. At times, the gaps in Robinson's narrative signal more unambiguously that she is actively refusing to describe rather than simply unable to. My second example comes at the point in the narrative when Robinson takes to the stage to support her profligate husband and her baby daughter. Discussing her acting debut and the London society to which she's introduced as a result, Robinson bemoans the, quote, perils of a stage career. She describes the stream of offers from wealthy men to become their mistress. And she says, were I to mention the names of those who held forth the temptations of fortune at this moment of public peril, I might create some reproaches in many families of the fashionable world. Among others who offered most liberally to purchase my indiscretion was the late Duke of Rutland. A settlement of £600 per annum was proposed as the means of estranging me entirely from my husband. I refused the offer. Robinson here distances herself from the stereotype of the 18th century actress, so often conflated with the courtesan. And yet again, there's more going on in this scene than a self-vindicating display of chastity and fidelity. She also implies that the designation of volatile and dissipated from the previous example pertains not to herself, but to this plethora of moneyed male suitors who attempt to take advantage of vulnerable women as a matter of course. Embedded here is a social critique of the gender and class power dynamics of the late 18th century world of the theater. On the next page, Robinson makes clear exactly what she will not tell us. I shall not enter into a minute detail of temptations which assailed my fortitude. Robinson makes us aware in no uncertain terms that she withholds information. She will not list all the suitors who propositioned her. She will not shame them or their families. Again, the suppression of information invites the reader to speculate as to the names of these unspecified gentlemen. And presumably for contemporary readers, quite a few names would have come readily to mind. Yet here, Robinson is not only eliciting sympathy, but also stirring up curiosity and sparking indignation. She's also acknowledging that her memoirs comprise only a partial disclosure of her life. In this particular instance, of course, Robinson's censorship is easily and indeed openly justified. She doesn't want to injure or anger these families of the fashionable world. But it may be in moments like these that Robinson signals to the reader that her style and strategy of self-representation is purposely restricted. She avows her concealments openly. It's a bid not only for sympathy and trust, but for respect and possibly even collusion. She's a canny and discerning narrator who exercises wise discretion in what she will and will not share. And she has good reason for doing this. She must guard her public reputation, what she calls in this passage her, quote, unsullied name, and also her image in the eyes of the world. These phrases connect her failure to speak with her preservation of her repute as a woman of moral worth. During a period with a near insatiable appetite for representations of female performers, Robinson's memoirs both feed into and resist this desire for disclosure. She uses silence strategically, showing us that she won't show us everything and letting us know that this restriction of access is part of a strategy for protecting her, quote, name. Now, critics have found a bewildering contradiction between her awareness of her own selfhood and her effusions of private sensibility. Others can't pin down the image that Robinson is projecting of herself and regard the memoirs as not only confusing, but confused. I'm suggesting, in contrast, that maybe Robinson is not confused, but tactically towing a line between privacy, secrecy, and silence on the one hand, and authenticity, sincerity, and disclosure on the other. And more than that, letting us know that she's doing it and showing us why. My final example comes from one of the most painful episodes in the narrative, the moment when the prince breaks off their affair. Robinson has described their visionary happiness during the year that they're together, and she explains that she knows the danger of committing adultery, of leaving her steady stage career, of becoming dependent on the prince. But she takes the risk because she feels sure of their love. When he abandons her, she is amazed, afflicted, beyond the power of utterance. She says, "I wrote immediately to His Royal Highness, requiring an explanation." Soon after, she says, "My agonies were now indescribable." Soon after this, her narrative ends completely and is resumed by that third party I mentioned earlier. First linguistically and then textually, Robinson asserts that she cannot or will not describe fully the agonies of her heart. In fact, she's already described quite a lot. She's described her happy relationship with the prince, her surprise at his change of heart, her fear of leaving her husband and of leaving her profession. But there are many emotions we might expect that she does not describe here. Again, anger at her husband or her lover for mistreating her, outrage at society for giving her so few opportunities to support herself, regret, humiliation, jealousy. We are left to imagine this emotional prism, and so to identify and commiserate with her all the more. As Jonathan Lamb has argued in his Evolution of Sympathy in the Long 18th Century, it is not through our senses that sympathy works, but through the imagination. Robinson's decision to curtail description and to signal explicitly that she's doing so forces us to undergo this imaginative process of engagement. That the narrative here frustrates our expectations of the memoir form may make it doubly effective, adding an element of surprise. Lamb suggests that surprise actually heightens the passionate spontaneity of sympathy because, he says, sympathy thrives in situations of comparative powerlessness in which the function and tendency of social roles is no longer directly apparent. Here, in Robinson's narrative, the memoirist has ceased disclosure, has stopped writing, and seems to have disappeared from the text entirely, leaving the reader to fill in the undescribable gaps. Robinson, then, is not so much, as critic Ann Meller has argued, a, quote, tortured heroine of suffering who speaks to a sympathetic listener, as one who suggests, insinuates, or implies, leaving us to infer what's in the spaces based on our own experience. This strategy of self-representation follows partial confession with sudden concealment in order to win compassion. In so doing, Robinson keeps a degree of privacy so that a part of her internal world remains sheltered from view, even in a memoir of her life. This contradictory combination of revelation and refusal, what the German sociologist Simmel terms as semi-concealment, has been linked by modern scholar Jill Perry to the complicated relationship of the 18th century actress and to her audiences, both on and off stage. Semi-concealment involves presentation and disguise in such a sequence that the whole is fantasized more vividly and desired more readily. According to Perry, it also involves ornamentation, for we conceal that which is adorned and thus draw attention to it. Robinson may be appropriating this gendered mode of spectatorship practiced on the stage as an acceptable and even enabling method of balancing the perception of the actress as highly visible public spectacle with emergent notions of femininity as modest, virtuous, and private. To conclude, then, the gaps in Robinson's memoirs are not just simple instances of self-censorship. Instead, I'm arguing that these moments of self-proclaimed linguistic failure are silences pitched to elicit sympathy, trust, and respect, whilst also stirring our curiosity and fascination. They comprise a key to Robinson's strategy of self-representation in the memoir, suggesting that its inconsistencies, partial admissions, and gaps are deliberately positioned and signaled so that Robinson can admit her caginess without losing our sympathy. Though these irregularities have been dismissed as failures by critics, it's worth remembering that this memoir has not been out of print since its publication in 1801. Though it may not have achieved the aim that Robinson avowed, that is, bringing a vindication of her reputation, it did, without a doubt, achieve what may have been an unspoken aim. It held the attention of readers and contributed to keeping her reputation in public circulation. Though silence has been associated with disappearance and invisibility, it seems that Robinson's strategic deployment of silence may, in fact, have helped her to remain present, at least in the imaginations of posterity. Thank you.
So up next, we are going to have Elizabeth Denling, yes. The Horrid Mysteries of C1C126, A Tale of Mothers and Daughters. Elizabeth Campbell Denlinger received her PhD from New York University. She is the author of Before Victoria, Extraordinary Women of the British Romantic Era, which was published by Columbia University Press in 2005. She's the co-author of Shelley's Ghost, Reshaping the Image of a Literary Family, published by the Bodleian Library in 2010. And she is the curator of the Carl H. Forsheimer Collection of Shelley and His Circle at the New York Public Library. So please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you. I have a very soft voice, am I audible? I think I'm audible. Horrid Mysteries of Claire Claremont 26, CLCL 26, A Tale of Mothers and Daughters, which you see here. My paper today is not much like the abstract you may have read, although my subject remains the group of manuscripts cataloged in the Forsheimer Collection at the New York Public Library as Claire Claremont 26. While there are Gothic elements in there, when I tried to make sense of them, I realized that the domestic mysteries of these papers were more baffling and compelling to me, mysteries of authorship, timing, intention, and effect. There is indeed enough mystery for a far longer paper than I can give. Sorry. But I intend here to set out the difficulties, to consider some possible explanations, and to explore briefly some of the meanings and resonances produced by Claire Claremont's falsifications of her mother, Mary Jane Godwin's, unreliable narratives. To begin with, a short history of these papers. In 1997, the Forsheimer Collection bought what Sotheby's described as some thousands of pages in a box. These were the papers from the collection of Harry Buxton Foreman, the scholar and forger, that had gone to his son, Morris Buxton Foreman, a South African emigre, and after his death to a friend named Ernest Pereira. Claire Claremont 26 is 159 pages of Claremont's copies of letters which she sent to E.J. Trelawney, not only Byron and Shelley's friend, but also a longtime admirer of hers. Their correspondence between 1822 and 1869 was intermittent, but in that year they both took it up again with energy. Trelawney, who had published Last Days of Shelley and Byron in 1858, now asked Claremont for her memories of Shelley and later for copies of his letters. Claremont responded with appreciation and much-needed corrections of Trelawney's memoir and found in him a sympathetic ear for her passionate outpourings against Byron, in whose care Allegra, her child by him, had died in 1822. After Claremont's death in 1879, a number of Shelley's admirers pounced upon her niece, Pauline Claremont, looking for the papers. Among them were Edward Augustus Silsby and Harry Buxton Foreman. Foreman was the one with the ready cash, though Silsby had already extracted the best pieces. If you want the romantic version of Silsby's story, you'll find it in the Aspirin papers. Claire Claremont 26 is the largest bundle of these papers. So it contains centrally copies in her hand, Claremont's hand, of five letters from her mother, Mary Jane Godwin, to their mutual friend and Claremont's protector, Margaret King Moore, Lady Mountcashel, dated between August 7, 1814 and July 28, 1815. Claremont claimed to have received these from Lady Mountcashel during a visit to Pisa in 1832. They narrate in detail the elopement of Mary Godwin, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and Claire Claremont, and its aftermath from the Godwin's point of view. From time to time, Claremont footnotes them with explanations for Trelawney. Finally, the bundle also contains rough drafts of much of this material, including the letters to Lady Mountcashel. It has long been known that Mary Jane Godwin's letters were factitious. Edward Dowden, describing this bundle of papers in an appendix to his 1886 Life of Shelley, set out the situation clearly. He had not incorporated them into the main body of work because I was able to convict Mrs. Godwin of deliberate dishonesty in several important matters, and I knew that she wrote under the influence of feelings which would probably lead her into a perversion of the truth. Further, he could not trace the originals that had been in Lady Mountcashel's possession. Capping it all, he writes, an earlier and a later copy in Miss Claremont's handwriting lie before me. The earlier exhibits certain passages composed or recomposed by Miss Claremont, the text as she designed it to stand, emerging from a tangle of canceled words and phrases, alterations, interlineations. Yet I have little doubt that in many parts it represents with tolerable fidelity what Mrs. Godwin wrote. The evidence leads one to believe that where the transcriber desired to omit or alter any statement or to insert anything, she did not hesitate to do so, but that in general no ground or motive existed for such alteration. So that her transcript may be accepted as representing the original in essentials. Still, it is very far from possessing the authority of an original document. Edward Dowden's assertion that Claire Claremont had no ground or motive for her revisions is my point of entry, as no one, even in the semi-post-Freudian age, believes in groundless action. I should note from the outset that Claremont was perfectly capable of accurate transcription. Her copies of letters from Shelley, both Shelleys, in this packet of manuscripts, for instance, only have a few minor errors. The motive for both Mary Jane Godwin to write the letters and for Claremont to revise them is the protection of her reputation, saving her from the public and private humiliations that came from her association with Shelley and Byron and from being the mother of an illegitimate child. In Claremont's case, this was Allegra, who died in 1822, aged 5. But the two other participants in this literary campaign were also mothers of illegitimate children, a boy and girl in Mary Jane Godwin's case by different fathers, and two daughters in Lady Mountcashel's by her common-law husband, George William Tye. Lady Mountcashel had a comfortable and stable income even after she separated from her legal husband, Stephen Moore, Earl Mountcashel. But Claire Claremont had to earn her bread, which she did as a governess, and her livelihood would have been ruined by the truth. Mary Jane Godwin could not at first conceal her illegitimate children. When she was forced into debtor's prison in 1799, she took with her the baby whom she called Jane and whom we know as Claire, and wrote a series of energetic and successful letters to the child's father, Sir John Lethbridge, demanding support for the child, support which continued until 1814, the year before Lethbridge's death. In an early letter to him, Mary Jane DeVille, she was later Mary Jane Godwin, assured him, I have the means of concealing my engagements from the world. Those means she took up again when her daughter followed in her footsteps. Mary Jane Godwin's chief means was the ready power to lie. She told Godwin she was a widow and her children that they had the same father. Even the name Claremont is a fiction of hers. Her letters to Lady Mountcashel now survive only in Claremont's copies, and I'd like to examine the narrative they convey in some detail. So this is a fair copy of the first letter. There are 5 altogether, and they purport to be written at the time of the events they describe. The first is a panicked note dated August 7th, 1814. You remember they ran away July 28th, 1814, telling Lady Mountcashel that they're gone, the kids are gone. The Godwins believe they've headed to Italy, and they beg Lady Mountcashel to try to get Claire into your possession. Like all the letters, it's addressed to Casa Silva in Pisa. Lady Mountcashel spent the latter half of her life there, taking the name of Mrs. Mason after the teacher in a book by her old governess, Mary Wollstonecraft. This is the shortest of the letters. The second, dated in the fair copy August 20th is the longest. In the rough draft, it's dated August 16th and September 2nd before the writer settles on the 20th, which you can see at the top, the changing dates. After hoping that Lady Mountcashel, Mr. Tye, and their two little girls are doing well, Mary Jane Godwin describes in detail the elopement on July 28th and the events that led up to it, including Shelley's flirtation with Frances Emily Godwin, Mary Wollstonecraft's elder daughter, Clara Claremont's sisterly relationship with him, Mary Godwin's return from Scotland when all our troubles began. They include Shelley's falling in love with Mary Godwin, Mary Godwin's promise not to encourage him, discussions with Harriet Westbrook Shelley, Shelley's dramatic threat in the Godwin's schoolroom of double suicide with Mary Godwin, crying, "They wish to separate us, my beloved, but death shall unite us," as he handed her a vial of laudanum and pulled out a pistol for himself. And Shelley's attempted suicide by laudanum at his lodgings a week after. The letter describes the trio's elopement, their flight to Calais, pursued by Godwin's friend and helper, James Marshall. Here are some of the problems with this narrative when we compare it with Godwin's diary and what we know of Lady Mountcashel's life. Lady Mountcashel visited the Godwins in London on the date of the letter, August 7th. She, along with William Tye and their little girl, Laurette, were on their way to Italy, but they traveled slowly and did not reach Pisa until October 18th, 1814. Although the second letter mentions your two little girls, Nerina was not, the younger, was not born till June 1815. And it was Mary Jane Godwin herself, not James Marshall, who pursued the three to Dover and thence across the channel to Calais. This is the only place in the drafts where I've actually found a mistaken verb tense. The rough draft says he took to her much like a brother to his younger sister, for she was so childlike. Scratch out is so childlike for her years. The third letter is dated November 15th, 1814. Historically, the runaways returned to England on the 13th of September. They were back in London and in touch with the Godwins 2 days later, with Mary Jane and Frances Imlay Godwin talking with the three of them through a window on the 16th of September. Moreover, on the 13th of November, Claire, who at this point is, her name is shifting between Jane and Clara in the journal that Mary Godwin was keeping with Shelley, Claire was summoned to Skinner Street on the assertion that her mother was dying. Shelley noted in the journal on the 14th, "Note from Clara. I wish this girl had a resolute mind. Without firmness, understanding is impotent, and the truest principles unintelligible." On the 15th, Mary Shelley writes, "Jane calls, converse with her. She goes to Skinner Street, tells Papa she will not return, comes back to Nelson Square with Shelley." Between these notes and Claire Claremont's own journal, there is no doubt that she went willingly with Shelley and Mary Godwin, and that she preferred to stay there in the uncomfortable household they made up. The letter, dated November 15th, however, describes the Godwins' anxiety over the missing girls, especially Claire, and complains that despite their efforts to contain it, the story has got out and caused a number of their acquaintance to drop them. It recounts the rumor from the mouth of Harriet Shelley that Godwin had sold them for £700 and £800 apiece to Shelley, describes the superior education that the children of the Godwin household received, which might have made Mary and Claire all the more attractive to Shelley. Some other salient discrepancies between this letter and the facts are that Harriet Shelley, said to have called the other day, had not called since July, the Godwins had not seen her since August and may never have seen her again. The families alleged to have dropped the Godwins either didn't drop them or had done so long before the summer of 1814. The fourth letter is dated 7th February 1815 in the fair copy, and both 7th February and 7th April in what seems to be two drafts begun separately. So the fair copy, quite tidy. That's a footnote at the bottom. I think this is the later rough draft, the first rough draft. It narrates a long visit between Mary Jane Godwin and Claire Claremont in the Temple Gardens, during which Claire gives a detailed account of their departure in July and some parts of their journey. Mary Jane Godwin recounts how Shelley refused to let Claire or Mary eat meat, how Claire's color is faded, how Shelley set her lessons reading Gibbon, Tacitus, and Etienne de la Boetie every day. And we know what they were reading, and the only one that actually matches up is Tacitus. She describes Shelley's fear of Mr. Leeson, an Irishman supposedly pursuing him, whose very existence is doubted by most of Shelley's acquaintance. Both the fair copy and the rough drafts peter out into descriptions of the phantom Leeson. The final letter, dated on the first anniversary of the elopement, is largely concerned with the events it had on the family's happiness and reputation. Historically, in July 1815, Claire Claremont had been in Lynmouth in Devon since May, as the relations between her and Mary Godwin had become unbearably stressful. Mary Jane Godwin, in this letter, claims responsibility for finding her daughter a place to stay, but it's more likely to have been Shelley's doing. And though she dates her letter from London, Mary Jane Godwin herself was on holiday at Lyon-Sea on July 28th, 1815. Nonetheless, she recounts that everyone in London is unhappy. William Godwin will not tell her how much he suffers, but Mary Jane Godwin surmises by his dejected look that his mind is still acutely wounded by the abduction of his daughter, whom he still has not seen. Francis Godwin takes no interest in anything and continues to be so melancholy it is most sad to Mr. Godwin and me to behold her. Claire Claremont is prevented from returning to live at Skinner Street for the sake of Francis's prospects. Mary Wollstonecraft's two sisters run a girls' school in Dublin, which the Godwins are hoping Francis will join as a teacher. And one of the sisters, Mrs. Bishop, has written to say she could not permit her niece Frances to associate with a girl like my daughter who had run away with a married man. Frances never did join the aunts in Dublin, and the account of her melancholy is one of the most credible aspects of these letters. Mary Jane Godwin then describes writing to Shelley, furious about this matter, just furious at the damage he has done to her family. He writes back to say, quote, he should never regret having rescued one victim from the tyranny of prejudice, and then a long discourse on the evils of society, very fine, very eloquent, but too long for me to insert here. I've gone over this narrative at some length in hope of giving you some of its flavor, dramatic, dubious, full of emotion, highly protective of the whole Godwin family, but of Claire Claremont and William Godwin in particular. It is impossible to check all the lies they contain, but the shifting dates and the contradictory facts make it incredible, at least to me, that Mary Jane Godwin was writing at the time of the events she describes. I suspect that she may have written an account post facto to Lady Mountcashel, possibly as a continuous narrative, possibly in five letters. If I had to guess when she wrote them, I would make it sometime after the deaths of Harriet Shelley and Frances Imlay Godwin in later 1816, events that covered all survivors with shame, especially Percy Bysshe Shelley, but the Godwins too. I wondered if they were written after Shelley's death in 1822 when Claire Claremont's reputation became key to her survival as governess. However, there's so much detail in the letters, even when the detail isn't entirely pertinent, that I'm more inclined to place their writing sometime not too long after the Shelleys and Claire Claremont met Lady Mountcashel on September 30th, 1819. That is, sometime before time had taken its inevitable toll on Mary Jane Godwin's memory. In a prefatory note to the last letter, Claremont tells Trelawney that she omits the beginning as it consists merely of inquiries after her family and some business about finding a publisher for one of Lady Mountcashel's books, Advice for Young Mothers from a Grandmother. So, and this book came out in 1823. So my guess is sometime between late 1819 and before, whenever in 1823 it came out. I don't think they were written after Shelley's death. And I add that postquem date speculatively, only because I don't quite believe that they could have been written in the immediate aftermath of that death, given its disastrous effect on everyone in his circle, even Mary Jane Godwin. So the meeting in 1819 through a letter of introduction from William Godwin is significant because Lady Mountcashel, who this is the only pretty slide I've got, so I'm going to leave it there as long as I can, became Claire Claremont's particular friend and protector. On a visit to, so and Shelley's and Claire Claremont called her Mrs. Mason. Everyone did in Italy. On a visit to her in 1832, the year in which Mrs. Mason is said to have handed over the letters, I'm going to start skipping. Actually, I know what I'll do. Claremont wrote to Mary Shelley, "Nothing can equal Mrs. Mason's kindness to me. Hers is the only house except my mother's in which in all my life I have ever felt at home. With her, I am as her child. From the merest trifle to the greatest object, she treats me as if her happiness depended on mine." In the very first of the letters, Mary Jane Godwin pleads with Lady Mountcashel to do her utmost to get Claire back because she knows that Claire loves her and that this emotional bond is there. So I'm suggesting then that Mary Jane Godwin sent letters to Lady Mountcashel that were fictitious from the start, dated without reference to Godwin's diary. It's impossible to know exactly how Lady Mountcashel felt about receiving them, but if it's true that she gave them to Claire Claremont in 1832, we can infer at least that she approved of this effort enough to hold on to the letters. The fact that all three women had children out of wedlock must have been a powerful, though possibly unspoken, bond amongst them. It's more than possible that Claire Claremont was not told she was illegitimate at all. And it's not difficult to see why the letters would have been precious to Claremont, why she would have saved the copies, why she would have wanted Trelawney to have them. They present her as childish and innocent, utterly duped by Shelley and tricked by both Mary Godwin and Shelley into leaving Skinner Street. During her adult life, Claire Claremont felt, with considerable justice, that she had been hard done by, and she brought to her lot a temperament that unerringly found every available source of suffering. For instance, in the same 1832 letter to Mary Shelley, in which she appreciates Lady Mountcashel, she delivers this championship-level moan with extra points for humor. "I can say from experience that the wonderful variety of miseries in the world is truly astonishing. If some Linnaeus would class them as he did flowers, the number of their kinds would far surpass the boasted infinitude of the vegetable creation. Not a day nor hour passes but it introduces me to some new pain, and each one contains within it swarms of smaller ones, animalculi, pains, which float up and down in it and compose its existence and their own." Claire Claremont was alone in the world for most of her life. These letters bring together the only two people who made her feel she was first in their hearts, the only two in whose houses she felt at home. She must have felt that the letters protected her both in themselves and in their power to create her side of the story for posterity. So I'm going to skip bits at the end where I start looking at how she revises her mother's letters. It becomes very detailed, and yet it's not enough detail, but this is going to become longer. I'll just say at the end, there's one bit that's really odd. Do you see this cross that line? Then she speaks angrily about Claire. It's the only one in here where there's this third person interpolation. Then she speaks angrily of Claire. And then you go back to the first person, Mary Jane Godwin, saying, "I was very angry at Claire." This sounds like somebody summarizing a source. If it's right, what we may have here is a tiny interpolation implying a source outside Mary Jane Godwin's original letters. Only one person could have furnished that source, Lady Mountcashel. One is inclined to add in the study with a pen. I do think we might consider the possibility that all three of these women may have been involved in producing the letters. If Claire Claremont in 1869 and 70 were not copying, but also actively recreating her mother's letters from copies and possibly summaries that she made in 1832 in conversation with Lady Mountcashel, that would explain at least the curious feeling that the letters as a whole convey, the feeling that they are neither real nor wholly spurious, too detailed in some places and strangely lacking in detail elsewhere. Barring the recovery of originals from the Palazzo in Tuscany, where Lady Mountcashel's descendants have lived for most of two centuries, not likely, although not out of the question, this mystery will remain a mystery. We know for certain that the letters represent not just a twisted version of a famous story, and not just a missing file in the world's great archive, but also the work of women whose maternal solicitude and knowledge of shame and penury brought them together to protect one of their own. Thanks.
Thank you so much for that. And next up we have Jaylon Kosker, who is a PhD candidate at the Department of English and Creative Writing at Aberystwyth University. Her thesis, Violet Fane's Intellectual Biography, aims to reclaim the poet and novelist Violet Fane, also known as Lady Mary Montgomery Curry, to contemporary scholarship by attracting attention to the marginalized political edge of Fane's writing and placing her in the London literary scene in the last three decades of the 19th century. The project is heavily dependent upon archival research conducted at the University of Reading Special Collections, where Fane's personal papers are held. And her title, as you can see, is The Fragmentary Memoirs of Violet Fane.
Thank you. I have some, if you're interested in who she is, I have a handout that I've taken from the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, and they're here. Towards the end of her life, the 19th century poet and novelist Violet Fane, whose real name was Lady Mary Montgomery Curry, resolved to write her memoirs. During the course of her literary career, Fane had often incorporated autobiographical elements within her work, but when it came to writing her memoirs, Fane refused to conceive of the project as an entirely autobiographical endeavor. Adopting the form of what Linda H. Peterson has called domestic memoirs, Fane chose to record the events of her life in relation to the wider context of her family history. In this way, Fane's attitude towards her own biographical writing seems to conform to Peterson's opinion that women's domestic memoirs in this period often seems to have conceived of the feminine self as relational, which, for Peterson, is indicative of a woman's tendency to focus on relationships with another person or group as opposed to herself. Though unfinished at the time of her death in 1905, documentary evidence suggests that Fane intended for her memoirs to be comprised of several volumes, and for its temporal span to stretch back to the 16th century. Today, only three fragments of this memoir survive in Fane's archive at the University of Reading Library. As a researcher into Fane's life and work, this absence has proven to be both frustrating and, as shall be discussed in this paper, illuminating. Sandra Gilbert and Susan Gubart have suggested that the woman writer's quest for her own story is also the woman's quest for self-definition. And when discussing memoir writing in general, Patricia Hample has pointed out that if we refuse to create a personal version of the past, someone else will do it for us. Fane's attempts at autobiographical writing are highly evocative of the sort of challenges and obstacles that surround such attempts at self-definition with regard to women's life writing during the 19th century. In Fane's memoirs, as we shall see, we find evidence of both internal and external pressures that proved inimical to Fane's literary quest to her own story, which in turn presents considerable challenges for a contemporary scholar of Fane's life and work. Rather than espouse any sort of overarching thesis, within this paper I would like to share with you some of these challenges in regard to my own research. Oscar Wilde once described Fane as being both a poem and a poet in one, and William Harold Malick echoed his contemporary when he described her as being a living poem. Such statements, though intended as compliments, actually seem to overly aestheticize Fane's life and appear to play upon a masculine conception of Fane as some sort of enigmatic and performative other. During the course of my search into Fane's archive, I had hoped to discover a more realistic and less compromised depiction of Fane and her life, as articulated in her own words. Instead, I discovered that Fane's attempts at autobiographical writing reveal elements of self-censorship for the sake of 19th century feminine propriety, heavy-handed editorial impositions on the part of her male relatives, and a seemingly subversive attempt to question preconceived notions regarding the material form that such writings should take. To describe these elements of Fane's memoir to you, I will discuss each of the three fragments of the memoir that I have survived in turn. Fragment A is a typescript copy of Fane's memoir created by her youngest brother, Sir Charles Anthony Lamb. It is a 45-page document and represents the most complete version of Fane's memoirs to have survived. Moreover, of the three fragments I have discovered in Fane's archive, Lamb's typescript was also the last to be created. In an editorial note on page 24 of the document, Lamb informs us that his typescript was produced in 1933, well after Fane's death in 1905. The first page of the typescript features this note that you can see at the top, which was written by Lamb. These memoirs, which were never completed, were written by my sister Mary Montgomery, Lady Curry. They contain some very interesting details connected with her early life at Beaufort. The memoirs are contained in four manuscript books, numbered 4 to 7. Book numbers 1 to 3 are missing, which is the reason why the story has no definite commencement. From this information, we can discern that the original memoir that Fane worked on during her lifetime, but which she never finished or published, was composed of 7 individual books by the time of her death. Lamb's typescript is a copy of only the last 4 books of this original document, because he was unable to find the first 3 in Fane's papers after her death. Obviously, Lamb cannot be blamed for his inability to find the earlier books of the memoir. However, his editorial stance towards the remnants of his sister's original documentary is worthy of scrutiny. As his introductory note demonstrates, Lamb not only typed his sister's memoirs, but also played the role of an editor by including explanatory notes and clarifying comments in bracketed sections within his typed version of the memoir. Such additions, what we might refer to as Lamb's editorial voice, often disrupt the narrative flow of the memoir and are highly distinct from Fane's own voice within the text. An example of such discontinuity comes in the form of Fane's description of her uncle, Captain Somerville Waldemar Burgess, a man whom Fane claims deserves a whole chapter to himself. In this section of the text, Fane describes how handsome her uncle was, even into his old age, and then describes how he came to have his leg amputated. Later, she declares that she will transcribe a letter from her uncle to his father in its entirety, to demonstrate what a dutiful son and a gallant soldier he was. At this point, Lamb's editorial voice interrupts Fane's account by declaring that the letter mentioned is not included in the manuscript. He then goes on to point out the inaccuracies of Fane's account of Burgess's life. The tone of Lamb's interruption, in contrast to Fane's own writing, is decidedly unsentimental. For instance, unlike Fane, Lamb never refers to Burgess as his uncle, nor does he offer impressions he had of the man. He just states historical facts. Such editorial additions, though intrusive, do not seem to distort the original text, which would seem to suggest that Lamb restricted his role as editor to that of a copyist and a commentator. However, when Lamb's typescript is compared to the next fragment of Fane's memoir that has survived, we can see that this was not the case. Fragment B is not listed in the catalogue of Fane's collected papers, and I only discovered it after having read Lamb's typescript. It consists of 11 loose manuscript pages, which are written in Fane's own hand, and I may add, terribly written. Careful scrutiny reveals that they contain the text of the first four pages of Lamb's typescript, which suggests that they were originally part of a much larger document that Lamb transcribed his own copy of the memoir from. These few loose pages, then, are the last remnants of Fane's own version of the last four books of her memoirs. For our purposes, what is important is that when this document is compared to the corresponding pages within Lamb's typescript, we can see that Lamb made significant changes to the text of Fane's original version when producing his posthumous copy. For example, in Lamb's typescript, we get the following passage. "It did not seem possible to my father, however, to behave in anything but an unexpected manner. Contrary to all known precedent, and with all his gifts, he seems to have been little more than a human feather to the breath of woman." The same passage also appears in the fragment of Fane's original document, and it is considerably more elaborate. If only it had done so, one cannot help wondering whether events would have been so very difficult after all, as it did not seem possible to my father to behave in anything but an unexpected fashion, and nothing unconventional, something romantic and unlooked for, would have been certain to have influenced him somehow, and who knew what direction the wind would have blown upon one who, for all his gifts, was nothing more than a human feather to the breath of woman. Lamb omits Fane's dramatic touch, and he also softens Fane's sharp critical judgment about their father. Such changes represent unambiguous censorship on the part of Lamb, and calls into question the level of fidelity of his own typescript to Fane's original memoir. In this way, we can see that Lamb significantly reshaped Fane's memoirs. Moreover, because the majority of Fane's own version of the last four books of her memoir no longer exists, we can also see that Lamb's extensive alterations have influenced the way we know of Fane's life today. In addition, Lamb's intervention is not the only example of how Fane's life writing was censored, and thus redefined by her male relations. Her diaries, which are also held at her archive, tell a similar story. In her 1901 diary, just after a series of entries that describe a difficult period between Fane and her husband, Sir Philip Currie, a large number of pages are ripped out as if to conceal the issue entirely. An anonymous note that comes directly after the ripped out pages speculates on the cause of this action. "It looks very much as if Lord Currie, or some later descendant, tore out pages that shared only too clearly that this devoted pain has drifted irrevocably apart. Something not known to the present generations. Minnie is Fane. Fane may have been exasperating at times, but Philip Currie evidently had a bad liver, as well as a great opinion of himself. I have always thought he looked bad-tempered." I would suggest that Currie's or some later descendant's intrusion into Fane's diaries irrevocably changes the way we perceive these figures today. Another such intrusion comes after Fane's last entry into her 1905 diary on the 14th of September. At this point in the diary, Currie notes Fane's death on the 13th of October, and from then on, starts to keep the diary himself until the end of the year. Though the act of tearing out parts of the diary and then invading its privacy by keeping the diary, Currie, like Lamb, also reshapes our record of Fane's life. In her book, 19th Century American Woman Essayists, Sherry Lee Lincoln writes about a similar case in which Arthur Fuller edits his sister Margaret Fuller's 1844 book, Summer on the Lakes, after her death. Lincoln suggests that Arthur Fuller understood that his sister was an exceptional woman in many respects, but was also seen as a somewhat aberrational woman. By deleting a great deal of material from Summer on the Lakes, Lincoln suggests that Arthur Fuller refashioned his sister's work to represent the author as other than a completely deviant relative to the standards of the 19th century. And in this way, Lincoln believes that Fuller sought to mitigate his sister's questionable reputation. Lamb and Curry, in their turns, might have had similarly benevolent aspirations with editing and reshaping Fane's life writing. However, regardless of their intentions, it is undeniable that they significantly contributed to the difficulty the contemporary researcher faces in attempting to accurately reconstruct Fane's life. Ultimately, we can see that both Lamb's typescript of Fane's memoir and her own diaries are compromised documents that do not fully reveal Fane's own reflections on her life. For some time, these documents were the only source material available to me in my attempt to piece together Fane's biography. However, more recently I have discovered another fragment of Fane's memoir that is considerably less compromised than either her diary or Lamb's typescript. And this document is the final fragment that I will discuss today, Fragment C. As I have mentioned earlier in this paper, Fane intended for her memoir to be compromised of several volumes. Lamb's preface to his typescript to the memoir informs us that they were originally contained in four manuscript books, numbered 4 to 7, and that books 1, 2, and 3 are missing. In regard to this last point, Lamb was, in fact, mistaken. After having spent a great deal of time sorting through the documents within Fane's archive, I have discovered a copy of the first 3 books of Fane's memoir that are written in Fane's own hand. At first glance, this version of the memoir appears to be nothing more than a collection of many and other cards, mainly calling cards, that relate to Fane's life as an ambassadress in Rome between 1898 and 1902. However, what makes these cards special is what is written on their reverse side, which is, in fact, the first 3 books of Fane's memoirs that Lamb thought were missing. The form that this document takes is certainly unusual, and it may explain why Lamb overlooked it. It consists of 115 many and other cards, all of which have been cut in such a way to make them a similar size. For this reason, Fragment C looks more like an aesthetic endeavor rather than a literary manuscript. Moreover, the seemingly ephemeral documents that Fane opted to use do not appear to have been selected entirely at random, though the reason behind their selection is obscure. For instance, on the back of an invitation to view the robes to be worn by the female members of the peerage at the coronation of King Edward VII in 1902, Fane recounts the adventures of one of her ancestors that fought at the Battle of Waterloo. Both events are clearly tied up with ideas regarding a celebratory sense of British national identity. But what is perhaps most interesting is how Fane's choice of writing material draws attention to her own social standing while also praising her family history. Though my study of this document has only really just begun, I suspect that it represents a seemingly subversive means by which Fane sought to record her own achievements while ostensibly conforming to the structure of Peterson's domestic memoir. This, of course, leads us to question the seeming self-censorship that is implicit in Fane's adoption of the form of domestic memoir, which, according to Peterson, restricts a woman writer's ability to write of herself in anything other than a relational manner. Fane's choice to adopt such a restrictive form of memoir writing, which places her in an extended family unit, instead of a professional memoir that would require an account of her life and literary accomplishments, represents a way in which Fane exercises self-censorship. In conclusion, we can see that Fane's attempts at autobiographical writing exhibits evidence of both internal and external pressures that proved unfavorable to Fane's literary quest to her own story, in the form of the intervention by her male relations, as well as her tendency to exercise self-censorship through the adoption of the domestic memoir form. These issues, in turn, present considerable challenges for a contemporary scholar of Fane's life and work, and they not only irrevocably change the way we perceive her, but also leave gaps in the narrative of her life that are very difficult to fill. However, Fane's use of personally significant ephemera as the pages upon which the first three books of her memoir are written may perhaps represent an original and fascinating method of subverting the restrictive form of the domestic memoir, and therefore, in my opinion, is worthy of greater attention. Thank you.